they would take the script that the writer had sent us, put it in the envelope, and say to the playwright, "This is safe, go be brave."
Hi there, and welcome back to another episode of the I Should Have Learned This Sooner podcast. I'm so excited for today's guest. AP Andrews, aka the one and only Superior Nebraska, is a really good friend of mine here in Los Angeles. We did a drag competition together back in 2019 and became really close friends. And I loved every minute of this conversation. Oh my God, so many little amazing tidbits. So without further ado, let's jump right into it. Here we go. I am here today with someone super special, someone that I competed in a drag competition with recently. What's your name?
My name is AP Andrews, but my drag name is Superior Nebraska.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know you really as AP. I'm like Superior or Nebraska. People call you Nebraska.
Call me Nebraska. Yeah, or just Sup. but yeah, that is my hidden identity.
So let's jump right into it.
And, sure.
For the people listening, tell us who you are, what you do, and what you want people to know about you.
Yeah. Okay. My name is AP Andrews. I feel like I'm introducing myself to you.
That's fine.
I'm a playwright, a TV writer, film writer, and also a teacher, and I work as a drag queen. And also the literary manager for a new play development company. So a lot of different hats that all kind of, I think, have started to sort themselves out into being just like falling under the guise of an artist. So that's the kind of that's the path I'm on right now. I was born and raised in the small town of Superior, Nebraska. So my drag name is very imaginative.
It works.
And exactly. And then from Nebraska, I went to New York, where I studied at NYU, studied theater and playwriting, worked as a literary manager for a while, lived and worked in London for a little while, and then went back and got my master's at Hunter College, and then came to LA about a year after that. I've been in LA now for about a year and a half-ish,
okay.
I think.
Awesome.
I'm bad at math.
It sounds like you've lived your life. Like, you know, you've lived a lot and you still have a lot to do.
I have, yeah. I certainly have. It's been a long 30, almost 31 years.
Oh, we're the same age.
Yeah.
Old. No, I'm just kidding. One of the things, like, people always like to say 30's old, but the way that I think about it is, like, first of all, it's probably about one third of the lifespan that you expect to live,
yeah,
roughly, if you're going to live to 90, whatever.
Right.
And then your memory span, like, you probably remember really only like half your life. So,
oh, if that. I have a horrible memory. Horrible memory.
Well, good. You're going to forget this.
Exactly. No. Never.
So we, even though we know each other, mm-hmm, I feel like we don't really like know each other that deeply. So as I told you before we started recording, one of the things that I like to start off my episodes with is there something, a book, a person, a song, something that inspired you in your life and sort of has led you down the path that you're on now?
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess preparing for this a little bit, and it led me into a lot of deep thinking, really, of just about where I've been. It's been a very tumultuous couple of years, I think. One of the things that I actually wrote down was a quote that meant a lot to me during that time, and still does mean a lot to me during that time, which is, and I brought it on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Have enough courage to trust love one more time, and always one more time. Attributed in this instance to Maya Angelou,
yeah,
but I don't really know if that's, I don't know if that's true or not. But yeah, I think the ability to, pick yourself up again after being knocked down, and the ability to do that, not just in work, but also in relationships, also in your personal life. Like, I think, starting to make those connections has been one of the biggest things that I've been experiencing over the course of the last several years, that I wish someone would have told me
right
before then. Whether or not I would have been able to hear it is another thing. But I come from the theater world, right? Mm-hmm. And working as a writer, I was lucky enough to be invited to McCall, Idaho, where they have this kind of national development conference for new plays, right? Basically, the idea is that you, as a playwright, go work with a professional director and actors for a week on your play, attempting it to make it better in whatever way you can, right? So I went there as a playwright twice and then started working there. The fancy word is dramaturg, as a person who,
dramaturg.
Yes. Okay. who is basically a person who advocates for the script.
Okay.
It's the person who asks questions of the script. If you're working on a Shakespeare play, the dramaturg is the person who's like, this is probably what they would have been wearing during that time.
Okay.
If you're working on a modern play or one that's being developed, it's like, this doesn't really make sense. You might think about that a little bit, you know? So I've been working with them for 8 years now, I think.
Wow.
And it really, I think, is the place where I started to think of myself not as, I guess not so much as a student of the craft so much, but one step more, which is just like a forever student of the craft.
Right. Oh my God, and, so true.
Yeah, yeah. And as someone who, and as an artist, like as a person who is always learning, who's always questioning, and was able and was lucky enough to begin seeing that not only through my own work, but in trying to help other playwrights to write the best play that they could write.
Mm-hmm.
One of the philosophies there is not to like try to make the playwright write the play that's in your head, like try to make it better in the way that you think it is. Because that's never actually better. Like what we're trying to do is get the story that's written on the playwright's heart onto the page.
Right.
Right. And this may seem like kind of like a topsy-turvy journey to get to the thing that I'm talking about, but I promise it's not. But one of the things that we say at the beginning of this conference, when these playwrights are flown in from all over the country and actors from all over the country, nobody knows each other yet, and we're getting ready to go into rehearsals. Basically, each of these writers has about 27 hours with this group of people to do the work that they need to do when they're there. And one of the things that we tell people is like, if you think, oh, I should try that, and you wait until the next day to try it, 6 of your hours are gone, and you've wasted time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Try it. The worst that can happen is that it doesn't work, and then you know it doesn't work. So when you go back to your hometown and you're working on the play there, you can go into it knowing that that is not an avenue that you need to explore again, right? That's not wasted time. When that happens,
right?
It's in fact, if you get into the habit of doing it over and over and over again, and you know, even if you shoot about 25% with things working, like, if you're doing that, over time you build up muscles in your body as a writer to consistently be putting yourself out there, continually taking risks. With the knowledge that they're not all going to pay off in the way you want to, but they also might lead you to what ultimately will work. You can look at a mistake and say, oh, that doesn't work because X, Y, and Z. Let's try it again with ABC with that knowledge, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What I learned there is, you know, there were sometimes we would work on a play for an entire week, and at the end we would try so many different things and none of them would quote unquote work, right? We would sometimes like be reading the script that was very similar to the one that they brought in, but the playwright left with so much knowledge of things that don't work,
right,
that would have taken them a year to do without the kind of intensive environment that it was in. Long story, not all that short. What I realized after, you know, working for that conference for a while and working with several playwrights who had varying levels of resistance to this idea, is that it's something that the idea of just making a grand charge toward your work every time you sit down saves so much time and energy than sitting around and wondering why it's not working. Take a guess, see what happens, you know? And so now I go back there every year and work as the literary manager. So I read most of the scripts and help the artistic director pick the scripts that come to us. But I work a lot closer with the playwrights. And one of the things that Jenny Mahoney, the artistic director, always says, that kind of sends shivers down my spine at the beginning of every conference, is she says, she takes the, and this is from a director named Lloyd Richards, but they would take the script that the writer had sent us, put it in the envelope, and say to the playwright, "This is safe, go be brave." With the idea that if you leave here at the end of the week, you already have a great script. Like, you can always go back to this. This will always be here. Don't panic. Mm-hmm. Like, you could delete half the script to see if it works, and this will still be here. And that's something that I started taking into the rest of my life, which is, I'm going to be okay. Like, I know, the experiences that I've had have led me to this point. And as long as I'm continuing to try, doing really whatever in the best way that I can try, right? With the best of intentions of doing what I think is the best, I will at least be learning. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah.
You know?
Definitely.
So that's like from a very specific world that I feel like maybe not a lot of people have much of a glimpse into, which is theater development, right?
Right.
But it's something that I think since then I try to apply to my own life, but also look for in other people. And it's become kind of a way to think about, for me, a way to think about failure. And to think about when things don't work out the way that you envisioned that they might. Yeah. I think it's easy to take a lot of time moping about that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've realized from being in that very intensive environment of having just a little bit of time with the people around you, all of whom are trying to help you, right? You really have to use every moment that you can to look at the thing that didn't work and recover quickly,
right,
and take another go at it. When you start thinking about things that way, for me, failure starts to not only be something that bothers me less, but also I start to like have questions about the whole concept. If you can always be learning something, does failure even really exist? Or is it just trying, you know? Is it just, you're just learning a way that doesn't work, you know?
I heard a really great quote from, I believe it was something Tony Robbins related, that he said, which is, create for the trash can.
Yeah.
You know, he tells, if you want to become a songwriter,
yeah,
you're going to write a million songs that go in the trash can.
Yeah.
And then one of those songs will be one that you turn into an actual song.
That's true.
But it's so true. Like, you can't go out and expect everything. We live in a world where it's like you post something to social media, mm-hmm, and you know, like, you know, okay, this is the great one. So you only post this like fake self, this like constructed, you know, this is who I'm going to make everyone see. But we also live in a world where it's like you don't see the stuff that people are doing behind the scenes,
right,
the editing of those photos, how they took, what, 100 selfies to get that one that they posted to Instagram. They edited out something in the back, whatever it might be. So, oh yeah, I totally get
exactly.
it.
Yeah. I feel like we sometimes don't see the process. Like, we've removed the process from the way that we look at things. And therefore, if you're trying to create something and it's not immediately perfect, you feel like you failed in some way. The fact of the matter is you just didn't see the other person failing. And they've in my opinion, just gotten better and better at failing up, failing hard, and like and picking themselves up quickly. Yeah. You know, so yeah, I think like that concept was something that I ran with and really helped me move from a place where I was thinking about my work in commercial terms to thinking about my work in how it was successful for me. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
How
yeah.
I was getting to a place where I was sharing things that I wanted to be sharing with mm-hmm. people in the way I wanted to share
them. Authentic rather yeah. than perfect.
Right, right. Which in its own strange way, if you aim for the authentic, it starts to become a kind of perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
To you.
To me.
Exactly.
And other people see in it something authentic mm-hmm. and therefore might start to believe that it's right. perfect. Right. Where really it's just authentic.
What if what I love about like watching you perform is if you take the idea of yin and yang, right? Mm-hmm. Chaos and order mm-hmm. is it's like you have these concepts, but it's also like watching a beautiful like moment happen because you can see that concept go into a little bit of like chaos
yeah.
in that it's still held together. It's not like bursting at the seams,
yeah.
but it's like so poetic to see that whenever you get on stage. And it's like, I don't know how to describe it beyond that. It's chaos and order. It's
yeah.
beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you. And I think that is something that I wouldn't have been able to do if I wouldn't have, you know, come from this, you know, world of learning about failure in that way and being comfortable with failure. Mm-hmm. Lord knows some of my drag performances may be considered by others to be failures. But for me, it's always, I go out thinking this is the best that I can do with this. We're going to see what happens. We're going to see what works. I'm going to give it my all. Like I always, if nothing else, I will always give it my all.
Passion.
Yeah. Sometimes those things crash and burn, and don't meet other people's expectations. But at the end of the day, at least I'll know they've met mine.
Right.
At least I'll know that if it doesn't work in the way that I want to, I'll have information about why. And with drag, you just do it again
mm-hmm.
the next day. Right.
And like, sometimes
the next week.
Sometimes it's change like it. At a different bar, you can do the exact same number
yeah.
and the floor layout and the audience that night, whatever it might be. It's like if you're a stand-up comedian,
yep.
you know, any sort of performance art that has an audience in a venue, you know, the location and the audience, the lighting,
mm-hmm.
the sound, like yeah. a siren can go. There are so many, you know, variables
yeah.
that go into a performance that one night that number could be terrible. And the next night it's like, wow.
Exactly. It landed in some
exactly.
way.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think too, there's this kind of push pull, thing that I've been experiencing recently as I'm relatively new to drag. Mm-hmm. But it's something that I experienced a little bit in theater too, which is, this idea of being able to live in the moment and to have the emotion of the performance go through. And to, my performances are often, we were talking about this just a little bit ago, chaotic, have a little bit of carnage, a little bit of rage inside yeah, of them, yeah. you know? And to realize that those are real emotions. Like those are things that I'm experiencing and that I'm expressing through drag. Mm-hmm. Right. And what I've figured out is that I have to be able to go fully into that land of emotion and experience it and live it, right? And after a performance, I'm exhausted. After a performance, I'm still feeling those things. I'm still thinking about the way that it landed or the way that I perceive that it landed, things that went wrong and went right, you know? And then at some point in time, what I've found, whether or not this is healthy or makes me a sociopath, I'm not sure, but like you have to find a time where you're able to as much as possible divorce yourself from the emotion of the moment
right.
and say, what just happened? What can I learn from that moment? How do I take another swing at that, right? Even if taking another swing at it means I'm never doing that number again,
right, right,
and
right,
this is
right.
why. finding the way to go back and forth between that, not thinking about like trying to not evaluate yourself while you're doing it, but at the same point in time afterwards, being able to like actually forget right. about doing it enough to evaluate.
I feel that so much.
It's tricky.
They can't see, but whenever you said that, my eyes just like widened because that's as being in that competition with you. What I found is it's like you start thinking of overthinking and then you get in your head and mm-hmm. it's like, oh, something happened that wasn't the way you planned it.
Yeah.
And then for myself, at least, I would continue to think about that
right.
throughout the rest of the performance. And then those things would compile. And by the end of the performance, I'd have this emotional weight of the 5-10 things that went wrong.
Yeah.
And what you don't realize is those people who are watching you externally, they don't know what that perfect was in your head.
Exactly. They have no idea. Right. And I think coming from performance and coming from theater, like there's a way that I've just lived around that a lot and know that if I go out there and throw myself into it, sometimes literally, I'm sure some psychiatrist somewhere can probably figure out how to make this work, but like I kind of black out mm-hmm. for about 3.5 to 5 minutes mm-hmm. while that song is going. I very rarely remember what happened during a performance after it's over. I have to really think about it or look at a video.
Oh, that's fascinating.
'Cause I'm inside of it. Uh-huh. I don't know.
I'm kind of the opposite. I literally, time slows down
uh-huh.
and it's like, this is going so slow a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm overthinking about it.
Right.
But like you said, whenever there, what number did I do? I did What a Feeling.
Yeah.
And I did that at Soft Butch, Redline, DTLA every Friday night.
Hey.
Throw that out there. And it like, I came out and Tito mm-hmm. Soto was in the audience and he was just like full of energy and like I just fed off of that
mm-hmm.
and immediately went into the number and it was like I knew what I was doing. It was that chaos and order again.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like I had it planned out. I prepped. Now all I can do is do it.
Yeah.
And go from there.
Exactly. You live through it. Yeah. And I think so as I was like trying to connect this and not so much trying to connect it, like it already connected, but I was trying to find words for how it connected really. But I think in the last like year and a half, 2 years for me, it's been a time of really tremendous personal growth too. And it wasn't growth by choice. Right. I was living in New York, was going through some really hard times. I got sexually assaulted pretty violently, at a time where I was, I wasn't taking very good care of myself. I was living, but really what that means is I was just living in New York City. I was just running myself to death.
Right.
When that happened, I think it just stopped me in my tracks. I was 3 months out from finishing my master's program. I was, just like in my personal life with friends and family going through a lot. And it just kind of decimated me. It sucks the life out of you. And it makes you rethink everything that you thought you knew about the way that people interact in the world, you know? It's a lot. And so from that moment, you know, it's something that I didn't share with a lot of people. It's something that I kind of kept to myself. And what I've realized, you know, is 6 months after that, I think I moved out of my apartment. Another 6 months after that, I moved to LA from New York, not really with any sure plan in mind. Yeah. But because I knew I had to leave.
Sometimes that's what you have to do. Just jump in.
I knew I had to
the deep end and see where you land.
Exactly. And so, you know, drove across the country, came out here, got a place, started doing drag not too terribly long after that.
I don't know. I disagree. Though, it's a little bit terrible.
Yeah. and it, I 3 years ago, never in a million years would have imagined that I would be sitting here right now. Uh-huh. Like never in a million years would have imagined that I would be doing drag ever. Like that doesn't make any sense at all. Mm-hmm. I'm a writer who sits behind the computer and, you know, doesn't really, I don't perform the story. Like I'm over here just watching. And I think only recently, really. My first drag birthday was recently, actually. And in looking back at that year, and looking at the people that I now surround myself with, most of whom I haven't known more than a year and a half, you know, my community's completely shifted. I can't help but think about this idea of failing, or thinking that you failed at something and picking yourself back up and taking another swing at it. You know, it's if you mess up a drag performance, or something goes wrong in a drag performance and you try it the next day, that's one thing. It's a little version of that. But I can't help but wonder if this wasn't just like a really long version that's taken 2 years, longer than 2 years at this point in time of my life, mm-hmm. to just figure out to be able to step back from the emotion of it, which is so raw, you know, and was so raw for so long, but to finally be able to step back and to say, okay, I'm good. Mm-hmm. This is safe. How do I go be brave? How do I, now that I think like have a little bit, I have a clearer view of who I am because I've hit rock bottom. I know what that looks like now. I didn't want it to. Like, it wasn't my plan. But that's a thing that happened to me that I can't get rid of now. And I know in my heart what I'm capable of now. I know I'm capable of that recovery. So a very good friend of mine from New York named Carolyn Cotillo has this podcast called How Happiness Happens. Yeah. And she studies positive psychology and the science of happiness at NYU and teaches there as well. But one of the things that she talks about and teaches about a lot is post-traumatic growth. It's this idea that there's kind of a slingshot effect when things like this happen. You get pushed to your limit. You hit rock bottom. Yeah. But from rock bottom, you're able to see the top, and you wouldn't have been able to otherwise. You make big life changes, not because you want to, but because you're forced to. You start to think about your life in a much more precious way, and you start to treat people around you in a different way. There hasn't been a moment since then where I haven't thought about, or very often overthought about.
I feel that.
Exactly. The way that I treat people in everyday life. Right? I approach people from a place of caring at this point in time because I know the world is scary. And I know that that's what I needed when I was going through my worst times, right? And it doesn't take me any more work to do that. Like, I'm just being myself. It changes. So yeah, it's changed, of course, me in a lot of very big ways, but also in just my every day-to-day life. And the thing that I had to relearn really was how to open myself up to other people after something like that happens. And I guess this is a way to come back to that Maya Angelou quote, mm-hmm. Which is at some point in time, you have to find the courage to pick yourself up and go again. You have to find the courage to love again, to, and again and again and again and again and again, in my case, mm-hmm. like to every single time swing for the fences. And then if it doesn't work out, think about why, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, mm-hmm. and then keep going, you know?
Yeah.
So it's strange. Like when I was first thinking about this, I was thinking about it in terms of theater and in terms of performance and in terms of the creation of art, right? But what I didn't realize is actually that that lesson is something that honestly probably kept me alive, mm-hmm. you know? Like really, really has carried me through, has built up that muscle memory of how to try again, how to not see something as a failure. I don't even see that anymore. When something bad happens, I immediately go to, you know, not woe is me, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm.
What
next?
Can I learn from it? What, or can I grow from here? Yeah.
Yeah. And then jump into it.
Right.
Cause life's short.
Right. I don't know if you know this, on my side, mm-hmm. On my left rib cage, mm-hmm. Whenever I was 22, mm-hmm. around 22, I got a tattoo that I drew, mm-hmm. of a bow and arrow, and it was very similar sort of storyline to the what you just talked about. Mm-hmm. And the quote that I got, the reason I got the bow and arrow is because of a quote that says, an arrow has to get pulled back before it gets shot forward.
Right. Yeah.
So we're kindred spirits.
Hey. yeah, but I think that's something that it's also incredibly hard to, what I've realized is that very often people who I know who are going through similar things, or just very hard things that are very different, it's hard in that moment, when you're living in that moment, to be able to say to yourself, okay, well, this is the bottom. It's okay. I'll learn from it and move on, right? You can't. You can't.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this is why I was thinking about this as something that I wish I had known sooner. Is like, if you're able to get yourself into that mindset of swinging for the fences, into that mindset of doing your best in work, right. in relationships, in everything that you do, right? And trying with the knowledge that it may not go the way you planned, but you'll at least know how to do it better next time.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get yourself into the muscle memory of that, when bad things do happen, you'll be much more able to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's instinctual. You won't have to think about it, because you're not going to be able to think about it when something bad happens,
right.
you know? And so when I see people going through things like that, you're able to tell from the outside, like, oh, this is horrible right now, but they're going to get through it on the other
mm-hmm.
side. I wish I would have been able to tell them this sooner and have them hear it, you know?
I feel like you should look into Buddhism
mm-hmm.
a lot, because a lot of the place that I've, in the same sort of time period where I've learned so much about myself.
Yeah.
I feel like, I don't know if you know what Return of Saturn is, but
mm-hmm.
that's a whole nother story.
Yeah.
Look into Buddhism, because there are concepts in mindfulness and equanimity,
right.
especially equanimity, that I think is something that me, who in the past I've had composure issues,
mm-hmm.
like letting something take me from 0 to 60 in anger, and
right.
it's like, boom, I pop off like verbally.
Right.
You know, I speak my mind and get frustrated. The thing with that is realizing that, you know, and if you've ever done yoga, like the mindset you're supposed to get in that whenever your body's in pain is, this is only temporary.
Mm-hmm.
Like realizing that, and it's, I think that's a big thing whenever you hit that 30 age, is you realize like, wow, and excuse my language, but I have to say like, fuck, I have lived so little of my life, but so much has happened, and I am not where I thought I was going to be, and I'm probably not going in the direction that I think that I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great quote in The Alchemist that says something along the lines of, by making a decision, you put into motion all of the things that, you know, you can't control, and whatever happens, by making a decision, those things are going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's too late. You've already made that decision. Even indecision is a decision.
Right.
But yeah, going back to Buddhism, equanimity and mindfulness, like mindfulness, I feel like you are so like calm and composed. Like I can't even imagine this like angry person except on stage. I feel like you are just so balanced in that way. So I'm having a hard time like picturing this like pre-superior
yeah.
AP person that
yeah. squaring the two.
Exactly.
You know, I think for me, it's tricky. I don't want to like go too far off course, but I think that there's a balance that I've found in drag that I didn't have in my life before, which was the way that I'm feeling on any given day. I can walk on stage and show to people and have there be very often, I think maybe, some sort of strange recognition in it, right? If I'm writing something about, for the theater, if I'm writing a play, right? Very often the theater, I feel like, deals with very weighty subjects in very weighty ways.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the goal is catharsis to some extent, at least in a traditional sense. Catharsis being, like, you want the audience to experience a mixture of pity and fear. Like, that's the high school definition we give everyone, right? You feel like you, when you leave the theater after watching a dramatic play, like something very important and deep has just happened, right? Everyone cried at the
same
time.
What was the moral of
this? Exactly. And I think with drag, for me, after everything that happened with me, I didn't write anything for a year and a half, 2 years. Whereas before, I'd been writing something every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, drag was a, because I think it had to do with the fact that my emotions were always changing. Like, I would be furious with myself one day, and the next day be perfectly fine. And the next day be sleeping all day, mm-hmm. like completely depressed.
And you have to do that.
Exactly. You have to, your body works its way out. Uh-huh. Like, it works its way through it. In drag, the turnaround time is so much quicker, right? If you're writing a play, if you're writing a novel, these things take years to write. And you're in that mindset the whole time, right? And there's something about the lightness of drag and the speed of drag and the length of a drag performance that allows me to look at things with a little bit more levity. And yeah, sure, drag very often is very comedic too, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But it allows me to look at things that are really dark. That if I was working on a play about something as dark as what I was going through for a year, mm-hmm. can you imagine how more depressed I would have been? But drag allows me to, every once in a while, just for 3 to 5 minutes, look at something really dark and to create an experience where other people can say, I've seen that too, and they can laugh at it, also feel uncomfortable,
right? Sometimes, like, you know, burning babies,
exactly, things like that. But I feel like it forces people to, in the guise of drag, which is this really fun, exciting environment, right?
Clown.
Yeah.
Buffoonery.
To clown. Yeah. It tricks people, I think, into thinking about things that they hadn't thought about before. Even just, I mean, that's what drag kind of is to some extent, I feel like, is to get people to think about gender constructs and gender in a way that you're tricking them into thinking about it. By doing it with a smile and by making them smile, you're setting it to music. Right. I mean, how much more user-friendly can it get? Yeah. But at the same point in time, how much less user-friendly can the material get? Like, you're talking about, those are big things to be talking about someone with. But if you do it in the guise of drag, it at the same time, it heightens the stakes, but also lowers the stakes. Mm-hmm. So that people are comfortable with being uncomfortable, right? I want to do that. Like, it's been a way for me to talk about some incredibly, incredibly uncomfortable things and live through some incredibly uncomfortable emotions, and to remain, like, as calm as I am naturally as a person, but to still feel those feelings that I sometimes have, to mm-hmm. put those into a performance and say, hey, you felt this way too, right? Like, and it's kind of scary sometimes how many people have felt that way too, you know? So I guess that's kind of where the drag persona fits into it for me, is finding the ugly and making something beautiful out of it.
I love that.
Oh, we'll see. I haven't got kicked out of too many bars yet.
Not yet. Yeah. It's the key part.
Exactly.
Of that.
Exactly.
You still have time. Just have a few more alcoholic beverages.
Exactly. Exactly.
You'll get to that point.
Right.
So I want to go back real quick to the conference that you mentioned earlier. And it made me think about, like, how we have to learn to see our own flaws,
mm-hmm.
because I had this one of the greatest experiences in my college art career, because I studied art and graphic design mm-hmm. in school, as well as many other things, as we all do, because mm-hmm. you have to. But I had a teacher who, the very first assignment, this was a typography class, and we didn't even have our computers out. He had us take out some magazines, cut out letters from them, and glue them to, you know, 6 by 6 inch squares, and then put them up on the board after like a day or two. And then He started at the very first one and he goes, all right, guys, what's wrong with this? Ooh, let me tell you, everybody, no one wanted to say anything because right. no one wanted to offend the other person
right.
whose work that was. So he was like, all right, let me tell you what's wrong with it. Mm-hmm. You know, the spacing here and this placement, blah, blah. And so you, whenever you have 30 of those on the board and he goes to the second one and he just told you three things that were wrong with that last one,
right.
you can now see those three. And so by the time we got to that last one, that 30th one, everyone's hand was up,
right?
You know, maybe except the few shy people or whatever.
Yeah.
But you then are able to see those mistakes. So no matter what you said something about this is safe, go be brave.
Mm-hmm.
Like once you know, okay, this is how to make it like good. I can make it good,
mm-hmm.
but what am I going to do now that I know the rules of how to make it good?
Mm-hmm.
What am I going to do to say, all right, how can I take that to the next level
mm-hmm.
and be imaginative, you know, like go into the future
mm-hmm.
and do something that no one's ever thought before. It's that whole, what, you got to learn the rules before you break them
exactly.
sort of concept.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love that because I have, in so many ways, like felt like I needed to live by everyone's rules.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just overthink in everything you do, like what are they going to think about what I'm doing? And as I mentioned to you from my first episode recording this podcast by myself,
mm-hmm.
it's just so easy to get wrapped up, whether it's drag, whether it's writing, whether it's creating a podcast, whether it's what you're going to wear out for the day.
Right.
Just thinking about what other people are gonna think of it. And I don't know if you know that one song that goes, my name's Blurry Face and I care what you think. Wish I could turn back time to the good old days. I'll look up the name later. Mm-hmm. But that line in that song, my name's Blurry Face and I care what you think, what I see that is somebody, as you walk down the street, you know, a lot of times people don't say hi, don't acknowledge each other. And if you make extended eye contact, like you might get a weird face, like an awkward smile or a nod.
Right.
But my being on the other side of that is like, your first thought is, oh, what, like, is something wrong with my hair? You know,
mm-hmm.
are they judging me? Then you start like getting in your head about, and they're probably not even thinking about that. They're probably mm-hmm. in their head about their own things. And they walk by and a minute later, you probably even forgot what their face looks like.
Yeah.
But in that moment, their blurry face and you care what they think.
Exactly. Yeah. It's true. I think too, what you just said also makes me think a lot about, the way, how I mentioned before, the way that this conference is set up, about how I'm not trying to make the play into the best play that I can. I'm trying to help you make the play into the best play that you can,
mm-hmm.
right? This idea that I feel like the more you can divorce yourself from what other people think and the more you can push yourself into being what you want to be, the more people will see that as authentic and not, and you won't feel as judged, right? In drag, that's been a gigantic journey. And still continues to be. Anytime you enter a new art form, anytime you enter a new line of work, I feel like there is that learning curve of like, oh no, I'm so far
right.
behind.
Right.
Right? Everyone has to be judging me. And it takes so much bravery when you're judging yourself so harshly to also go out in front of other people.
Right.
When uh-huh. you know some mm-hmm. of them are very judgy.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, whenever you are on stage
yeah.
and you see, you know, someone looking down at their phone.
Right.
You, oh, I'm not interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You see someone not laugh at something that's supposed to be funny.
Right.
It's like, maybe it's just the energy level of that audience. Maybe it's, you know, it didn't read the way you expected it to or in your head.
Yeah.
There's so many ways whenever you're judging yourself on stage that people are so wrapped up in themselves.
Exactly. Exactly.
That person on their cell phone might be dealing with their mother, you know, is sick.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the, I mean, I could talk to you about like this sort of topic forever because it's something that I too have gone through so much. And one of the most stressful things for me is commuting to work.
Yeah. Right?
People in cars are, they press that button for me. But one thing that I heard that really like, oh my God, why did I never think about it that way? It's like, you're so wrapped up in, oh, I need to get to work, or, oh, I need to get to this place by this time. But that other person, maybe,
right,
you know, their whole year has been rock bottom.
Yeah.
And today, like, they're on their way to a job interview and their baby, you know, got sick 10 minutes before and they had to clean up, you right. know, all these unknown factors. So whenever I get angry now,
mm-hmm.
I try to look at it and go, huh, I wonder what they're going through.
Right.
Right. What are they going through? Because I'm clearly going through a lot and I'm in my head about it myself, but they're going through something too.
Yeah.
And I can't compare their story to mine,
right,
and say that I'm better and it's more important. Because we all have our own.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's something I've started to think about a lot in the drag community too. I know this isn't like a drag centric podcast by any means, but like in terms of, I think what I'm trying to do and what I've been trying to do for the last like half of this year is, once I started to figure out kind of what I was, where I was and what I was trying to do, was that I have to be really careful about who I take feedback from. Because they're trying to get me to write the play in their head,
uh-huh,
and not the play in my head.
Yep.
And the number of people who I really seek out for feedback is smaller and smaller. But when I do get feedback from anyone, I always listen to it and then think to myself, how can I take that feedback in a way that's helpful to me?
Mm-hmm.
Very often it's very different than the thing that came out of their mouth, right? And so, yeah, I think it being, there are so many times when, you know, you're dealing with people who are going through so much in their life and they take it out on you in such extreme ways.
Mm-hmm.
Even, I mean, it's, there have been so many times where I leave a club and a couple hours later, I'm still upset about something that someone said. And then I'm like, wait a second. That's ridiculous. Like, we're not scientists. Like, we're not, you know, we're not curing cancer here. We got to take it easy on each
mm-hmm,
other.
Mm-hmm.
This is a community that needs to be nice to each other. They're clearly going through something. This ain't about me,
mm-hmm,
right? This isn't about the person they were taking it out on. It's big. And the more that you're able to, again, like practice using those muscles, the easier and easier it gets, I find.
Right.
I'm sure Buddhists and people who do yoga also find those things
right.
too.
Well, I mean, one of the, like, whenever you get feedback, one of the things that's really hard, right, is to not immediately take it personal.
Yeah.
And not to, like, as you said, overthink it.
Mm-hmm.
Or so, Rubella. First episode of the podcast.
Who?
My guest. Who? There go all your bookings.
I love you. Okay.
I will often ask for feedback on something or be like, hey, what do you think of this?
Mm-hmm.
And in my head, you know, it's perfect or it's great or
you didn't
whatever.
Really want to know.
Right. No, literally.
Yeah.
Right. You ask for that feedback. Like,
right.
Hey, what do you think? Like, oh, doesn't this look great?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about it? And then they give you that, their honest opinion,
mm-hmm,
how they feel about it or something they know that you don't or whatever it might be, but
right,
they tell you something that you weren't ready for.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how many times that has happened with her, where she'll say something and then I immediately snap back,
mm-hmm,
and say something in response. Well, I like it this way.
Right.
And then I'm like, oh shit, sorry. Go ahead as you were.
Right, right, right.
She'll get mad at me.
Yeah.
She'll be like, why do you ask me for my opinion?
Yeah.
If you're just immediately going to be like, well, I like it that way.
Right.
And then not do anything about it. But I have so many references that you're bringing up in me,
mm-hmm,
is I heard this thing, which was an author who had written a book and it was published and they were getting really down on the like reviews of the negative reviews,
sure,
right? But then they realized like the only person's opinion I care about are the people who were there for me before it got published.
Right.
Because this book is published now. You know, there's X amount of copies out there. I'm not going to recall them because this one person says, oh, I should have done it this way.
Right.
Like, there's nothing you can do. I mean, it with makeup and drag and costuming and stuff, you can go back and try something later and evolve and learn. But in the moment, like, if someone's giving you feedback on something that's already happened, great. You can't change that. Don't overthink it. Don't take it personal. Take that and move forward.
Right.
Move from that failure to bringing it into the next one.
Exactly.
The next failure.
The next failure. But it starts to be something that you look forward to, I think, to some extent. Like, there have certainly been times when I've gone out in drag for a number and it's like, the music starts and it's like, Jesus, take the wheel. You know, this is, oh boy. Are we all going to be on a journey together? You know, this is going to be a mess. Just you wait. And I think there's an excitement in that.
Right.
And being like, just what's going to happen next? And, you know, to the end about feedback, I think that's something that from Seven Devils, actually, that I've been able to think about a little bit is after every time we read these plays with an audience, so it's a room full of audience members who've come to listen to these plays be read out loud, we ask the audience to give their feedback. And sometimes playwrights are like, oh yeah, oh no, not this, a bunch of people who don't know anything about anything are gonna tell me how to write my play, right? But we've been in McCall now for 20 years this summer. The people who come to see those plays have been there for most of those years. And every time we sit down, we go through rules about how it's most helpful to talk about plays, right? We're not talking about the playwright. The playwright didn't live the things that are happening in the play. We're talking about the characters, right? We're also not talking about what the characters should have done or what we want them to do. We're talking about what they did and like our reflection on what we experienced. Maybe it was something other than what we expected, right? But if you're able to talk about what you saw, right, and not turn it into what you think it should be, that feedback can be so much more helpful. But what we've realized is that sometimes people are going to wander in. They're not going to know any of those rules. They're not going to listen to anything you say about how to talk about a play. And they're just going to launch. Like, they're just going to go for it. They're going to be like, you should have done this and this and this. This play was awful, blah, 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 blah. And every time that happens, we as moderators have to say, okay, put the brakes on.
Thank you. Next.
That moment. Well, yes, thank you. Next. But I think more importantly, thank you. And question mark. The idea that, okay, that didn't work for you. Let's talk about why. And not in terms of like, I don't think that person would have said that. Like, why? Like, what about the character leading up to that point leads you to believe they wouldn't? Or did you just not want them to say that? You know, because it's not your play. Right. Did it upset you and you don't want to be upset?
Right.
Like, that's your problem. But figuring out how to talk really, I think sometimes when I get feedback that initially makes me really angry, one of the things that I try to do is ask more questions about it to figure out, like, when was it when you felt that moment? Like, when was it that you felt that thing that I don't like? Was there a specific moment? And then I can think about it and say, maybe I want to change that. Or I can think about it and say, actually, I kind of wanted that person to feel it in that moment. Maybe that's what I wanted, you know? So being able to take the statement that the person makes and turn it into a question, to turn it into a more specific statement has been really helpful for me. And in a way, is kind of another way of recovering from failure, of a perceived failure. Like, when someone says to you that they have feedback on something, you're like, oh God, what was wrong? But really, to some extent, I took a swing at this. What did you observe? Can be super helpful sometimes.
Oh yeah.
If you're able to take it in the right way. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm gonna think about that too.
So we've been talking for a while, and I absolutely have loved this.
Aww.
And I'm sad that, you know, this can't be 5 hours long.
Our time is up.
So before we end it, I want to give you the opportunity to talk about what you're working on, where people can find you, especially, and follow up and check you out and learn more about you.
Sure. My address is
6969 Devil Way.
Sure. So I'm on as my non-drag self, I guess, or a different kind of drag, rather. AP Andrews, it's APA Rights. On all social media platforms. And then as drag, it's Sup Nebraska. That's SUPNEBRASSKA. Two S's because
there's an ass in there.
You think about it. Yeah. Sup Nebraska. And I am performing at the Eat at Brunch with a Rotating Cast on Sundays at noon at Redline downtown.
In Los Angeles,
hosted by Rubella Spreads. I'm a frequent offender at Big Chicks and Breadsticks on Wednesday, hosted by Cornbread Jeté.
And also at Redline in downtown LA.
Thank you, Redline. I try to pop up wherever they'll let me pop up.
Yeah.
But you can find out all about that on Instagram.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I love this so much.
Thank you so much.
It's been fun.
It has been fun.
All right, y'all. And that's the end of episode 3. I hope you loved that conversation as much as I did. If you enjoyed it, please check me out on Instagram at Contemporary. That's CONTIMPORARY. Like the word contemporary, but a little bit more fun. All right. Also, don't forget to subscribe to us on Stitcher and Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Music, .. etc., etc. Until next time, I'm your host, Tim Winfred. Talk soon. Music for this podcast comes from filmmusic.io. Acid Trumpet by Kevin McLeod. Incompetech.com. Licensed by creativecommons.org/licenses/by/4.0.